Hello and welcome to Sustain, the podcast where we talk about sustaining open source for the long haul. Who are we? Where did we come from? Where are we going? How can I get a better data transform in this thing? Very excited to talk to our guest today. I am your solo host today, so you don't need to worry about any other voices. It's just me, Richard Littauer. Hello, everyone. And the amazing Shanina Beshini-Saibene joining us today from Santa Rosa in La Pampa, Argentina. Shanina, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much for coming on. For those of you who don't know, Shanina is the R OpenSci community manager, but also the R Ladies project lead. And she is also the vice president for the board of directors for the Carpentries. So very much all the science, all the code, all the time. Besides that, she's a proud mom and she teaches at Outral, UCES, and UDE universities. She co-founded Latin R and Metadocencia. Basically done a ton of stuff in her life, topic editor for the Journal of Open Source Education, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Researcher for 24 years at the National Institute of Agricultural Technology in Argentina, and a self-described RSE. That's a research software engineer. For those of you who don't know, this is probably going to be one of those sustained talks where we talk about academia, code, and how do we sustain all the science that we do anyway. So Shanina, that's a lot to cover. It seems like you've had a full career, which is really, really cool. How did you get started? What came first? Was it R OpenSci? Was it the Carpentries? Was it just data management? How did you get into this whole field?
Well, I started as a researcher at INTA. When I started, I was still at the university. So I started as a, we call, technical assistant for researchers. My degree is in computer science, so I was working with agronomic engineers, met vets, people who work with ecologists and natural resources. So I was a kind of weird person there because I come from this non-traditional discipline. But very, very fast, me and my coworkers recognized that I have many things to give to science, especially because computers become something very useful, internet, be able to have the data in an order way and be able to process that data. So I started to develop software for them and to teach scientists how to use computing tools. So that was my start. That was 98 years. So I was 20 years old. I was really, really young. That's how everything started. Then I was developing my career, did my master thesis there. I finished my undergrad being part of INTA, and I started to put together my team. So at some point, I was in charge of more than 80 people who do computing stuff for INTA across the country. So we have the people who do IT, we have the people who develop software, we have the people who do modeling. So that was really, really interesting. And in 2017, I discovered ER Ladies. And that was a game changer for me in the sense of the international connections that give me. And these informal settings where I can be the teacher sometimes, the learners other times, and we discuss not only technical aspect, but also the context in where we do science, the context in where we teach as a professor, university professors. So for me was to discover a different space to still do science and do good and be able to discuss with other people what was going on in my life as a woman, as a Latin American, as a scientist, as a developer.
Amazing. So I'm unfamiliar with R Ladies. I just went online and I see that there are chapters in, looks like hundreds of places, 219 chapters in 63 countries. One of the things that's most curious for me, looking at this map of all the chapters, is that there's actually quite a lot of them in South America. Normally, when you see chapters of technology, it's like all in the upper half of the globe. Can you talk a bit about what the strength was of R Ladies where you are? Were there people meeting in person, or was this remote across an entire region? What did that look like?
Yeah, for R Ladies to start in the U.S., and then in 2012, the London chapter and the San Francisco chapter and the Taipei chapter comes together and they create Our Ladies Global. So that is the organization that we have today. It is a nonprofit organization with base in the US, but the people who are part of the board of directors come from every different part of the world. We have people from Europe, from the US, and from Latin America. And in the global team, we have people from across the globe too. So 2 years ago in Latin America, we have the same numbers of chapters that you can find in the Anglophone North America. So Canada and the US, we have the same number of chapters in Latin America, which is a huge accomplishment. Because as you say, usually these things are more in the global north than in the global south. And I think that the strength is actually the community. The chapters organizers are people who are very passionate about what they do. They found in this space a way to give back to the community. That sometimes it's hard to try to do some stuff on the teaching aspect at the university. And here you have enough informality, but also enough expertise to make this a special place to learn. So the rules in Our Ladies is you can organize your chapters with events. We request at least 2 events a year to be considered an active chapter. And that event can be absolutely anything that you want to. So it can be about coding, but it also can be, hey, come and try to give a talk for the first time here. This is a friendly space. This is a safe space. You are going to get feedback that is good for you. So come here to try do things that you afraid, let's say, for I can find a better word, but otherwise you don't have a place to be. To make those questions that perhaps in another space, people will say, oh, that is too beginner, or that is a silly question, or go to read the docs. So no one is going to tell you that here. No one is going to tell you that that is a silly question. And someone will answer you, or someone will go with you through the path to learn that together, if anyone there knows. So I think that that and the willingness to help each other in our career, in our learning, in how we are as professional, as women's or other genders minority, is what made this so special. So chapters help each other to organize events. Organizers share insights and tips and tricks on how to organize even or how to bring people to the chapter or how to get sponsors to make this continue, be able to do this. And in during the pandemic, I think that we saw a lot of that in the community. We stopped requesting these 6 month events that people should do because we say, okay, we are going to stop this requirement because people was through really hard stuff. So we saw a lot of events online. We set up infrastructure to do this online. And we see chapters getting together, organizing book clubs. We see chapters visiting each other, visiting online to give talks and to do workshops together, but to support between each other. So I think that is an amazing place to learn, to get help, and to give back is what do you want to do.
That sounds amazing. I really like that. One of the questions I have around how that works is I'm looking at your titles that you provided, right? So our OpenSci community manager, project lead at Our Ladies, and also on the board of directors for the Carpentries. Those are three different communities and different organizations that to me as an external person all do the exact same thing, which is teach you how to use R better. What am I missing? I see you shaking your head. What am I missing?
I think we do different kind of stuff. Our OpenSci is a community, people who use or develop R packages with a focus on science and data. Our Ladies is more general. Perhaps there is people that are ladies that never develop a package in their life, and that's okay because it's more a data science, but you have a lot of different kind of use of R as a language. At R OpenSci, the idea is that we have this peer review process that will help the author of the package to reach a quality on their software they develop. And I think that the thing that has in common are OpenSci, our ladies and the carpentries, that are safe space, where the all the goals of our activity is to help the people, whatever is a teacher, whatever is a package development, whatever is a data science, to reach the best quality they can in a really friendly way. So the peer review of our OpenSci doesn't have rejection. So 100% of the package that comes to the review process will be accepted. And the feedback is a loop where the reviewers and the author is open, is transparent, is non-adversarial, because the goal is to have the best software that we can have. It's not to reject software. We don't have reviewer two in our OpenSci. Doesn't exist. So I think that is the kind of the common aspect in these three communities that I love so much. It's also in carpentries. The way that carpentries teach is to include everyone, to help you to learn those coding skills, basic coding skills, and that you feel that you can code, that you can use these tools that are for everyone, that you don't born with that gene that only these special peoples can use the computer. No, that this is for everyone. So I think that that is why I'm in this tree community, even when there are different in focus and in activities. So for example, in our ladies, organizers, leadership roles that are all for women and other genders minority, that doesn't happen in carpentries or our OpenSci, for example. That is also because the focus is different. But yeah, in our OpenSci, we also are very concerned about community where you still have mainly white males, Anglophone from a few countries. And we are trying to address this, for example, with our Champions program, with our multilingual publishing project. So we are working on having multilingual documentation. We are working on translating a localization material. We have this Champions program where we focus on groups that usually are excluded from the open source movement, and we give them training, mentoring one-on-one. We help them to develop a project, which usually is a package, and we also pay them to be part of the program. So that is also a way to work on this different aspect of the diversity and inclusivity that we still need in our community.
Where's the funding coming from to pay these diverse contributors?
Yeah, for our OpenSci, right now we are working with the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, but we also have other grants like Sloan Foundation, DR Consortium, Nonfocus. So we have different funders. The same in the case of Our Ladies is top level project of their consortium. So they are our main funder. And then we have donations that individual people that also helps. And for the carpentry, it's also a set of different funders that are kind of the same that I mentioned for our OpenSci, Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, Sloan, Betty and Moore Foundation. I don't want to forget any of them, but they are in different moments of the life of these communities. Most of this community has more than 10 years. Our OpenSci is 12 years, Our Ladies is 10 years, the carpentry is 25 years. So there has been a lot of this different funding. And we don't charge for our services. That is the other question. Carpentry has this membership model that helps with funding, and our OpenSci is all based on grant and donations. And yeah, that is really tricky for the sustainability of the community. That's tricky, tricky, tricky.
That's what I was going to ask, is how do you envision a post-grant funded model for these communities? I see for Our Ladies that it's much more of a user group. It's much more people helping each other out. No one is excluded. We're here because we're volunteering, and we're here because that volunteering in itself gives you a sense of achievement and success and networking abilities that wouldn't come otherwise, right? It's very useful. And probably the technical overhead is hopefully little in terms of how much it costs to keep it running. But when you think of donations and time and translating, that's all huge amounts of labor. Can you talk a bit about any discussions you may have had, particularly on the board of directors for the carpentries, because that's probably the highest level, for where post-grant funding comes from?
Carpentry has this membership model where universities, institutions pay, and then they get different kind of benefit for that membership, like the workshops for their technical personnel or the instructor training. So they have their professors or technicians learning how to teach. Carpentry has the technical workshops, like how to use Git, Shell, Python, R. So more like these are technical skills. Then we also have this, how you learn to teach in the way that carpenters teach, that it is an amazing way to teach. We already know that that works. It's based in evidence. So every person who goes through some carpentry workshop or some workshop teaching with the carpentry philosophy is really happy. I use that in my university too with my students, and you can see how they learn, how the setting for learning is better because we use this technique. And then there is also the people who becomes the trainers, who are the one who can teach to you to become an instructor. So these are the three things that people who pay membership can get. And then anyone who is an instructor can have self-organized workshops that are not handled by the carpenters, but they use the material of carpenters. And also carpentry does something that I also think that is amazing, which is building this lesson in a collaborative way. So you have the lesson, and this has been built by people who teach and have been improving that lesson over the years. And yeah, the thing is, when you don't have enough membership and if you don't have enough grant, how you maintain giving the service to the community, including everyone, because that is pretty important for carpentries too. So in Latin America, we probably are not going to have the money to pay a membership as a university. And there is some also cultural barriers that we can find, like who will teach me or my professors to teach in English. So there is the language, that is how you can see that who can teach you how to teach. Probably there will be okay on someone to teaching coding skills, but I'm not so sure that the biggest of all this university will be okay someone to come and teach your professor how to teach, for example. I have my doubts that that will be something that happened. So how Latin America is part of the carpentry, if we can pay, and probably we are not going to be able to get members. So right until now has been because of grants. So this is still a discussion we have with no solution, but carpentries don't want to leave Latin America outside of what they do. So there is a lot of discussion. I don't think that is still a solution for this kind of things. It is a struggle that every single community has, because also funders will help you to start or will help you to pilot, will help you with something new, and then they will move to other interests and to others' community. There is little funding for maintaining what you already have, little. And as you say, there is some kind of task that it has to be paid, because otherwise you are not sure that you can continue doing this if you don't pay someone to do it, or relying only on volunteer work. For example, for the translation that we are doing at ROPENSAI, we pilot with Spanish, we create the infrastructure we need with some funding. And now that we set everything and we already tested and improved it, and we have a stable version of our infrastructure and our process to do translation, now the Portuguese translation is doing by volunteers. So that process, for example, is something that we see that we can do with volunteer, because the hardest part that was to create the process, to document, and to create the infrastructure we need, that was made with paying work. The review process at ROPENSAI is also volunteer, but there are some other works that are really hard to do it if you don't have someone who get paid for doing that every single day.
So I'm really curious about what you mentioned as cultural barriers. Professors not wanting to be taught by someone else, for instance. It's really interesting to me, because when I think about coders, in Latin America, I often think of my friends who I know, who I've met all over the world, who are from Latin America, who are bilingual. Why do you even need translations most of the time? You already know English well enough to code in English. It's not like Python suddenly changes how you define variables to something else. Can you talk a bit about how those cultural barriers play out and how translations aren't really enough? And what else can we do besides just throwing money at the problem? Why doesn't that work?
Yes, I agree with you that throwing money is not always the solution. You can have a lot of money and still don't spend in the right place on the things that you should. I have to confess that I approached the English language, human language, because I learned to code. So I was in love with computers since I was a little girl, and I started coding, and then I realized that that words were English. I was like 19 years old, but that happens to me that is, oh, okay, there's people who speak this other language. So the problem is that for coding in any language, it's not enough with knowing the functions or the syntaxes. That is not coding only. You need to understand the problem that you will solve. You need to understand the discipline where you are going to code that. And you need to understand the language in the general sense of how I apply this, how the language do this. And there's the sign issues also. How is the best way I can create this piece of software that will solve this problem? And that is a conversation. That is not a loop. That is not only coding structure. And that is usually in human language. So you need to be able to understand and communicate. And learning a second language is something that costs a lot of time and money. So you have a lot of people who will be coding, who will be doing science, and they don't speak English. I learned in 2017 when I met a lady, I didn't speak English, Richard. I only have the English in my high school one time a week for 45 minutes. And I didn't say a word in English. I could read, but I couldn't write either. So I'm for giving you a little some numbers of what means to people who don't have English as a first language, what implied to us, I will share with you some data of a recent study. For example, people who don't have English as a first language take 91% more time to read English papers.
Yeah.
For coding, most of the time you need to understand the methodology and what you are going to be coding. Up to 51% more of time to write papers, and the paper will be rejected 2.6 times more often. And if accepted, they will revise 12.5 more times just because of how you manage the language. When you need to present in English or speak at a podcast, so you need 84% more time to prepare the presentation. And a lot of people will avoid to do this because you know that you will not be able to communicate as you communicate in your first language. So for learning, for teaching, for discuss the idea, if you are going to wait that everyone learn English, you are going to lose a lot of talent, a lot of good ideas, and it's going to take a lot of time, and a lot of people will never going to be part of this. So that is why it is important to be able to have good material, quality material in different languages.
I would love to see the source of those. It makes a lot of sense to me. In graduate school in Germany, I was a very bad student. And I passed many of my courses only because I traded favors to people who were much smarter than me by proofreading their academic papers to make sure that it was academic English. And then they would help me figure out what was a for loop anyway. Thank you for sharing the manifold costs of being a non-native English speaker in science. That's from PLOS Biology by Amano Ramirez Castaneda, Verdejo Espinola, and others. That'll be online in the show notes. That's an excellent paper.
Yes, so, we have also some studies, for example, for the Linux Foundation, and they report English as one of the environment barrier to be able to participate in open source software. And English proficiency is a metric but why people judge you as a person, as an expert too. So if you have a choppy English, even if you are amazing, skilled coding people, developer, people will judge you with kind of, come on, what this person can know is look how he or she speak or write. So that is also has a lot to do on how you feel and why these spaces as urban side or ladies are important or carpentries. Fortunately, there are spaces where you don't feel that people are judging you in that way.
Y esa es la razón por la que no hablo español y alemán. Because every time I try to talk in another language, that's the reason why I don't. Because I'm an idiot, right? There's a thing in Italian phrase about that. To learn a language, you have to be an idiot first. Because it's hard and you're always stupid. Like, look, see, spot. That's what I can say right now. I have a question for you around all of these efforts to internationalize language courses, coding materials, programs like the Carpentries and so on. There's got to be a graph where it gets really hard at the beginning to translate stuff and there's no benefit. You're translating all these docs and no one cares because all the other stuff hasn't been translated or there's not any mentors in that language. At what point do you crest and you start to actually see a benefit for more return from a wider community entering that community because of the translation efforts, because of the language efforts? Do you have any conception of when you start seeing dividends as the result of that early investment?
Well, the first thing is to see that that material is used. So if you see that early this chapter are having book clubs on reading R4DS in Spanish, using the translation, that is a good sign. If people that apply, for example, at our Champions program, a lot of them come from South America. We did all the communication of the program in Spanish. We have our developer guide in Spanish. So we are having more people sending their package to review in Spanish that we also can do in Spanish. Now we are having our first bilingual review for one of the packages that have English and Spanish as the both languages. So I think that when you see that someone, you made the material, you translate, and that start to be used for teachers, for users, for developers, we are seeing the benefits immediately. For our OpenSci, we released the Spanish dev guide yesterday, but people already have been using. And the Portuguese community saw that and say, hey, let's start to have it in our language too. So no one is going to put that time for volunteer. It's not as useful for them and for their community. We start having blog posts in our website in Spanish and in Portuguese and Japanese. So we are speaking people in their context, in their native tongues, their phrases. Is translation is not a literal thing, that is so a cultural things in the sense of a phrase, an idioms, for example. That is pretty funny to try sometimes to translate an idiom from one language to the other. The examples and the context on how you are going to use this. Do you have the technology? Do you have the knowledge? I mean, Slack, for example, that is something that a lot of people use in a lot of places, and our community have this Slack space. I get to know Slack because of this community. It's not something that is used in Argentina, for example, in the academic space. This is with our OpenSci. Then we have, for example, I lead the translation of Teaching Tech Together, who is the Greg Wilson's book that is based in the Carpentries instructor that we teach in the instructor training. And we did also a book club. And then there is an entire community that is using that book to teach other teachers how to teach. So we deliver more than, well, I don't remember how many events we did, but we teach more than 2,000 teachers who speak Spanish with that book. And we be able to do it because we have it in Spanish. So I think that until now, the benefits in the process that I was part of on doing this translation effort, I saw immediately, and we still are seeing people coming because they feel part because this is in their language. And then there is also the representation. When you saw someone giving a talk in their native language, for example, I was part of the organizing committee at USER, the biggest conference, academic conference about the Arab languages. We have the first keynote in Spanish. And you have to see the comment of the people say, hey, this is so cool. This is in my language. I can see myself now that perhaps at some point I can be there. I can be part of that. The impact that that has in someone's perception of themselves, we can measure the power of that because you don't know when that person made that click. They say, hey, I can be there. I can be there speaking because I speak Spanish, so I can be there. We don't know what that can drive them to do, but that is amazing. That feeling enough is amazing. They feel in part, they feel that they are not only people who see the conference, but they are people who can speak, they can teach. This is a change on what you can be. That is amazing.
I like that. Of course, it's hard not to like that. Sometimes I wish I wasn't an interviewer because I don't like asking hard questions when it's just really nice. But it's also part of my job. So please forgive me for this next one. I had the privilege of living in Montreal for 2 years. Montreal is an amazing city and an amazing province, which is almost its own country of Canada. And of course, they speak French. When I first went to the conferences and to the working groups and the JSConf-like stuff, I was so excited to see people speaking English and giving no apologies and no excuses for doing so. Just standing up and being like, I'm going to speak Quebecois, you're going to deal with it, and that's just you. And I liked that. Over my years there, it became clear to me that Montreal is a wonderful city to live in, partially because it's cheap. And it's cheap partially because there's not a lot of money. And the reason there's not a lot of money is because the money moved to Toronto in the 90s. And because all the tech workers moved to Washington State. They moved to San Francisco. When you have a city of people who learn another language, become very good at tech, large corporations see that, set up an office, and then hire the local talent and remove them from that place and bring them to their headquarters somewhere else. So it makes me wonder about the strength of communities if we're raising people up to say, oh, I could do that too. And then they end up leaving their local community and having to go somewhere else and speaking in English during their day job all the time. So when we think about sustainability, are we just teaching people how to code in English or in their own language to snipe them and remove them from the equation to continue extracting from the global South? What's your opinion on that?
That's a very good question. Very good. The extraction is already here because if Montreal is cheap, imagine how cheap is Santa Rosa in La Pampa or Buenos Aires. So with one of the things that the pandemic changed or may realize some business is that they can hire talent in any place of the world. So what we are seeing here now is a lot of people working from enterprise outside the country. That is very beneficial for the person because the currency change is huge. So you get paid in dollars and you still live in Argentinian pesos. But the business here has to pay kind of the same that the international business in order to maintain that talent. And that is not easy. So right now, the issue, if you want to, is what the best one will get a job for someone who is not in the country, and the business in the countries need to equal the payment. I think that a lot of the local business or national business, they can do that because they are having also a lot of clients outside the country. So it's not that they can't for that, but they get used to pay as in the local reality, and now they have to compete with this more international way. So for the worker, that is not such a bad thing. What I see that is another still a problem without a solution yet is how you should pay. Equal work, equal pay, whatever we live. You should take into account the cost of living of each place. That is a huge discussion. And it's also affect a lot to nonprofit Our Ladies or Bonsai of the Carpentries, and affect the sustainability. As someone who lives in the global south, I also could say, hey, my cost of living is less because I don't have access to many things that you have also. So if I want to have access to this, I should be moving or living in another place, something that Shanina still don't want to do for many other reasons. My family, primarily, I want my kids grow close to their grandparents, and I still want to be able to be walking to every place. So I sleep in a rural area, really small place, and I'm very happy that it's quiet, that it's calm, but I'm far away of everything, Richard. Every time that I have to travel are 3 or 4 days before and after the moment that I have to be in another country. So what is fair? How we are sure that everyone gets paid what their work value is, that we are not exploiting people. There are discussions that we are having, actually. So how much my work living in Argentina value is as someone who do exactly the same that I do, but live in France or live in Toronto or live in Norway? Well, I don't have an answer, but I'm glad that we are having the discussions.
I'm going to need you to give me an actual, no, it's hard. there is no answer to this question. You know, I was reading Nature Graphic yesterday, and the average gross income for a year for someone in Nigeria, the average is $2,000. And so that's chump change for San Francisco developers. That's not even a line item, right? That's how much you spend on something minimal. And so I just really wonder how we have those conversations. Well, when we talk about open source communities and when we talk about non-extractive community building around maintaining open source software, because a lot of open source maintainers don't need that much if they're from the third world. And so what does it become then? Can we collectively say, oh, well, let's all donate to this person? I don't know.
You know, I have this mentor, this boss, that when we speak about why we do something, he and they always say, we have free currency of payment for every tax we do. We have the money and we need that one. We have bills. We need to pay that. We all want to live well, not luxury, but we need to pay those bills. The other one is the heart, how that activity makes you feel, how you are helping other people or giving back to your community or whatever you make you feel okay. That is something that warms you, that gives you joy. And the other one is the brain, how much you are learning, how much this activity challenges you, how much move you from your comfort zone and help you to improve as a professional, as a person. So I think that most of us start to do this volunteer work, not because of the pocket, because usually we have that solved in another activity and we do for the brain and the heart. We need the three types of currency, but I will say if we want more diverse voices, if we want to include more people in the discussion on the development of the open source software, and I think that we need, because my experience and my needs as a scientist, as a person who live here, are different than the one you have. And you only can know that if I told you, if I'm part of the decision table. We need the three, but we shouldn't say no to someone who wants to do that because they are learning something new. So my payment in Our Lady was to give back. My payment in carpentry was learning how to teach better. And I will volunteer for this too because I already get the payment that I want. We should try to see how we can give these three type of currency to everyone. And when we need money, have it so we can offer to those people who need it. In the champions program for our open site, we pay champions for their participation. And more than half of them, when we ask, they say that the stipend was important because they can allocate time to do the task. And they did an amazing job. In countries like mine, with the economic reality that we have now, the full-time job that you have usually is not enough. So you use your free time to do other jobs. So if you offer some kind of payment when it is an open source and open science activity, people can take and have that time for that because they get some kind of money for doing those. activities. But it's not that everyone will need the money as a payment for participation. But I think that has to be clear. You have to be clear on what are the perks to be part of the community, what you are going to learn, how we are going to recognize that to you. The contact network is still so important, Richard. So I wouldn't be here today without the contact network. And I know that. And that is also a way to pay the contributions. I think that we should be formalizing those more so people know what to expect and see their goals, their motivations align with what the community offers.
Excellent advice. Reminds me of Daniel Pink's book, Drive, Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us, where he says you need autonomy, mastery, and purpose, which is very similar to like bills, heart, and something difficult to do, your mind, right? It's all the same. So I love that. I think that's great. I think we could keep talking for a long time, but I'm not going to let us because we are running up on time. So thank you so much for joining, Shanina. Can you tell us where we can follow your words online? Obviously, our OpenSci and the Carpentries and our ladies, but do you have a blog, anything else like that?
Yes, I have my webpage, my blog. I will write. So then you can share, because I don't know how to say this in English. It is shabeshini.nellyfly.app, but it's the first two letters of my name and my last name. So it's kind of tricky. And that is my user name for every social media that you can find. I'm on Mastodon now and LinkedIn because of Twitter kind of disappeared. I'm not there anymore. So you can follow me on Mastodon also. I like to share a lot about these thoughts. Sometimes I rant. Sometimes I share nice thoughts or challenge or success that we have in our community. You can find me there.
And for those Anglophones unfamiliar with the Argentinian accent, that's Ya Bellini, Y-A-N-I-N-A, not Sha. Very confusing. But don't leave yet. We still have a bit more content for you. Now is Spotlight, the part of the show where we highlight other people, things, projects, mentors that we feel just need some light shed on them. Going with my longstanding tradition of using books instead of mentors, because I've run out because I've done too many podcasts. A book that I really enjoyed recently is one I'm currently reading, which is Theodore Rex. I've been meaning to read this book forever. It's the second in Edmund Morris's Pulitzer Prize winning trilogy about Theodore Roosevelt, a very complicated man, probably one of the smartest presidents we had. Racist, extractivist, had a lot of issues, but also set up the Parks Service and did a lot of really interesting things. So I'm really enjoying it. It reads like a thriller. I don't know how Edmund Morris did that. He was a fantastic biographer. So do pick it up if you like reading about dead white men. That having been said, Shanina, what is your spotlight today?
My spotlight is someone who I work with at Our Ladies, is Mu Athanasia Mo Mowinckel. She's a neuroscientist. She's in Oslo, Norway, and works at the Center for Lifespan Change in Brain and Cognition. And she is an amazing art developer, an amazing teacher, an amazing person. It's my friend, and I admire her so much. She is now the president of the Our Ladies Board of Directors and have been doing a lot of work for the community. She's also an instructor for the Carpentries, which show us that all the community comes together is part of our open side too. So please follow her, check her work, is amazing.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And you'll find all these links in the show notes. Listeners, I hope you have enjoyed this program. As always, there's a few things you can do afterwards. One, you can go to opencollective.com/sustainoss and you can donate. This is actually funded and it'll be really cool to have more people fund this work. So just go and give some money if you feel like this podcast should continue. Secondly, please share it with your friends and like it on Apple, Spotify, and all those things. That's how this thing works. You can go to discourse.sustainoss.org to talk about this podcast. We create a topic for each one. You can also find us on Mastodon and on Blue Sky and on LinkedIn. Those are the places where you can interface with us online. And of course, you can go to shabellini.netlify.app to read more about Shanina's awesome words. And Shanina, thank you so much for coming on. Mucho gusto, and wishing you all the best.
Thank you. Gracias. Muchas gracias.